The second speaker of our symposium is Steve Fuller, who joins us from the University of Warwick, somebody who's collaborated with Nico Scher on many occasions. The title of his speech is Nico Scher as a welfare state epistemologist. Steve.
Okay, thank you. First, I want to say what an honor it is to be here, because Nico Scher is one of the people who I think really is deserving of admiration in terms of his the autonomy of his inquiry over the last, whatever, four, five, six decades. and just getting stronger and stronger by the day, I might add. And that's a very important part, which no one has mentioned yet, that in a sense, I think he's just hitting his stride now. Okay, I want to put that on the table as an issue. And I have to say, I think I first met Nico when I was a graduate student 25 years ago, I think so. I've known him throughout my entire professional career. One of the things that's really very interesting is the way in which his project has developed, because I do think, this is why I chose the title of the talk the way I did, because I think in a sense, if you wanted to give a kind of a plot structure to the overall career of Nico Scher, rather than just thinking he's just going from one topic to another, you know, in just a sort of a happenstance manner, is I do think that in a sense, if you put his entire body of work together, you get the makings of something like something that could provide the epistemology or at least the sociology of knowledge foundations for the welfare state as we understand it. I guess I've been really moved in this direction, partly in the way in which Nico himself has influenced my own thinking and my own research. Some of you in the room may know that I'm known for this thing, social epistemology, which I founded 25 years ago, and it's been the subject of most of the books I've written over that period. But I do think a really important kind of decisive moment came when I was invited to be part of the Framework 6 project on converging technologies. Because I do think it was at that point, and this was a project, you know, multi-nation project, which Nico led from here, which was very much devoted to figuring out the nature of the human condition in the future, and specifically the way in which research in nano, bio, info, cogno sciences and technologies were going to be shaping that, and the extent to which there could be some kind of planning or policy for that. And in a sense, I do think that a project of that kind, thinking about those kinds of issues, are very much, you might say, a latter-day culmination of what I kind of take someone like Karl Mannheim was striving to do in providing the sociology of knowledge as a foundation for a science of politics in the 20th century. Now, we're in the 21st century, and the issues are different, and this is where all of these new sciences and technologies become quite relevant for thinking about how we actually talk about the sociology of knowledge. And there's no other thinker who's around now who's been doing this other than Nico Scher. He is the one who kind of has set the agenda for this. And I think it's in a very attractive agenda. And I think it is one that, in a way, very much plugs into how we might think about the welfare state in the 21st century. And here, I think, I refer to the book that's forthcoming with Cambridge University Press with Rainer Grundmann on the power of knowledge, which... We talked a little bit about some of the issues that arise there earlier today. I mean, this is basically a book where Nico and Rainer go through, as it were, sort of the some of the important signature moments of knowledge politics in the 20th century in order to provide guidance for how we might think about such matters in our own century. And this includes Keynesianism. And again, I think it became very clear. I mean, this is where I think Nico, having had a background in economics before going into sociology, I think is very relevant here, that he actually sees the sociological significance of Keynes much more thoroughly than I think anyone else does. And it's unfortunate in a way that this hasn't really gotten the kind of publicity that it deserves. But if one wants to talk about, as it were, Nico has really worked out the sort of sense in which Keynes is an exemplary figure for those of us who are in the academic world and want at the same time to pursue a scientific career and a policy-oriented career. I mean, I think that Nico's work in this area is really where to begin, and that aspect of the work is also represented in this new book. There is also discussion of the issues surrounding racial hygiene and eugenics in the 20th century in Germany, and also the more recent debates concerning climate change. Now, the thing about this, now, if I had to give a kind of a gloss, you know, so if I were the one who had to give the title to the book, I would say this is the foundations of welfare state knowledge, with these kinds of issues being discussed here. Because what we're talking about is various ways in which societies have thought simultaneously about making themselves more productive and progressive, that is to say, advancing the ends of the human condition, but at the same time securitizing against certain forms of risk. Okay, and the thing here is that all of these projects in their multifarious forms have been concerned with that, and that is what the welfare state has been concerned with. Okay, and I think it's very important to realize, because the welfare state is a term that I think has a kind of taken for granted status very much these days, but the idea of the welfare state is to be contrasted with the minimal state, where the minimal state basically just makes sure that people don't get in the way of each other as each person tries to maximize their freedom. Right, but whatever mistakes you make, it's your own fault and you suffer the consequences. Whereas the welfare state, in a sense, is very concerned that, in a sense, to a certain extent, that you are protected against your worst mistakes, and that those mistakes, once they are realized, are something from which the society as a whole can learn. So there's a sense in which the state has a kind of positive mission. It goes beyond simply protecting individuals from each other, but rather doing so in a way that it actually encourages people to take risks, and then from the consequences of the risks, one can learn, and then that can be fed into a kind of common knowledge base or something on the basis of which society may be able to progress in the future. And that's what the welfare state has ideally been about. It's been about this very delicate balance of individual right and duty even, and collective responsibility and collective will. And I think in a sense that this new book, and this is very much, I think, part of the way in which Nico's work has been going, very much gets us thinking in this kind of direction, that if we're talking about the construction of a welfare state in the 21st century, and it's something other than just protecting the capitalist economy from collapse, right? Because I do think it's, in a way, quite easy to sort of immediately accept what you might call, you know, Keynes degree zero, right? Which is the idea that you do the measures that are necessary to keep capitalism from self-destructing, but otherwise you just sort of let capitalism go about its work and you live in a fairly neoliberal environment. Right, but the welfare state is more than that, and it has to do with trying to actually encourage people to be the best kind of people they can be, and also realizing that this will involve taking risks of various sorts, and then securitizing with regard to those risks. And so when we move into so as I've been trying to think about this, going beyond just doing, as it were, the backstory of the 20th century, but thinking about where we might think about this in the 21st century, I've been pushing this idea of Humanity 2.0, which is the title of a book that I published last year and is something that I'm continuing to work on. And the core of that book was from this Framework 6 project that I was involved with Nico 5 years ago or so. And there I talk about various directions in which the human condition seems to be going at the moment, and I won't go into the entire argument of the book, but basically speaking, we've got two strong trends moving in quite polar directions. And the question is going to be, how are you able to have to provide a sort of common political environment, a common welfare state, in which those two polarities can actually coexist while they're pursuing quite radically different realizations of what it is to be a human being? Okay, so on the one hand, we've got the kind of people, the Peter Singer people, as I sometimes call them, right? The people who are into animal rights, who believe human beings have to get much more back in touch with nature, that our similarity to animals rather than our differences from them are the things that are the key to provide a sustainable existence in the environment in the future. Okay, that kind of approach. That approach often is represented, as I said, in animal rights movements, but also, you know, in terms of, you know, people breaking into the animal labs and in a sense wanting to curtail or in some way channel scientific research so that it no longer just simply privileges the ever upward advancement of human beings as if we weren't a part of nature. That's one side. The other side of those people, the Ray Kurzweil people, as I sometimes call them, who are very much into thinking that our biology is the problem, right? That in a sense, to realize the qualities that we most closely identify with being a human being, we have to distance ourselves as much as possible from our biologies, certainly from our the biologies of our birth. Okay, so we may want to talk about various forms of genetic enhancements and other sorts of biological enhancements, but in any case, the point of being a human being is to move as far as possible away from the biological origins as in Darwin's theory of evolution. Okay, and there all the cyborgs and cybernauts and singularity people and all those people fit into that category. And of course, you know, I'm giving you extreme versions here. But at the moment, various aspects of our culture are already preparing for one or the other or both of those kinds of futures in all kinds of lifestyle choices and things of that kind. And there we have an issue about what it is to live in a society that has, as it were, these polarities developing, and at the same time live in the same society, and as it were, with enough degree of respect and tolerance and so forth. And this is not just a matter of tolerance and respect at an ideological level, but this is where the point of the welfare state comes in. Also at a material level, because people will be taking all kinds of risks with themselves in terms of how they live their lives and so forth. And in a sense, we want to encourage that, I would think, as part of the human condition. In other words, we want people to, if they want to experiment with various forms of new therapies, that in a sense, you really don't know what the consequences of those therapies are unless people actually try them out and try to live normal human lives. Okay? I mean, there's a sense in which this is a kind of knowledge that has to be developed in practice, very much in the spirit of the sort of knowledge that Nico and Reiner are talking about in their latest book. And you actually have to provide the freedom and the opportunity for people to experiment with that. This may involve taking new drugs, taking risky lifestyle choices and things of that kind. But at the same time, we need to securitize that. That is to say, if people suffer enormous consequences from that kind of action, we nevertheless still need to be able to protect them in some way, either through compensation, through medical care, or something of that kind. Because whatever the consequences are of taking those sorts of risky choices, they are potentially of benefit to the entire society. Okay? And so even those who do not take the risks benefit from it. And that is a very important point because that is part of what we're talking about with a welfare state, right? Where, in a sense, you may not do the risky thing, but you should perhaps pay for it because you will benefit from it. And you see, it seems to me that as we think about the way in which we could have a welfare state in the 21st century, one that is, in fact, respectful of the divergent lifestyle choices and sort of images of what the human condition can be, that, in fact, we have to be thinking along the kinds of lines that I think Nico has sort of laid out the sort of background for in terms of talking about the way in which knowledge and power has so intimately been related in various welfare state interventions. And I do think, I mean, I don't have the time to go into this here, and I'll be wrapping up now, that I do think we need to think about the welfare state not merely in terms of the positive things that we associate it with, in terms of, you know, providing a sort of safety net for the poor, enabling them to go into employment and get training and things of that kind. Not simply that, but we also need to see as part of the welfare state's background history, which will, I think, be relevant again in the 21st century, is the history of eugenics. and the history. And so this is where the connection between Keynesianism and eugenics, right, and I would put the climate change thing in there too, is all part of a common package. These are not just three unrelated case histories. These are in fact part of the knowledge base on which the welfare state was established in the 21st century and remain relevant in our own time. And I think what we need to do is to think about how to take forward that kind of knowledge in a way that is relevant for the contemporary world we live in. And I'll stop there. Is that okay? Okay, and I'll take questions. I'm not sure how long I've been going on for.
Just fine.
Okay, well, I'll take questions. I'm sorry. Yes, Jason.
Okay, so it sounds to me like the substantive center is about human body and technology and the relationship with the body. But I'm also wondering about the normative appreciation of studying the social context that can encourage risk. And then there was the idea that, in general, society benefits from this. So if we shift the subject from technology in the body and we look at, say, the financial world, does the same still hold true? Does risk-taking in the financial sphere necessarily translate into broader improvement for all members of the welfare state?
Well, I mean, I'm not going to deny that there is an intellectual connection between the two things you're saying here, right? That in a sense, the idea of people rescuing the banks is in some sense because the banks are actually doing something quite valuable, but the kind of valuable thing they do sometimes goes badly wrong. But nevertheless, that doesn't mean you shouldn't stop, you know, supporting them, okay? I'm not saying I endorse this in the particular case, but I think the principle is okay. Okay? I think the principle is okay, actually. That in a sense, you do want to subsidize those aspects of society that are more willing to take risks if the knowledge that is produced by it is made available and useful to everybody else in society. That principle I stand by, and I think it's one of the ways in which we, who live quite different lives and decide to do quite different things with what we have at our disposal, are able to be part of a common project. You see, so I do believe in the principle, even if the particular case you raise is not the most attractive one. Sorry, do you want to follow up?
So to me, there's one other question. I think it's kind of related. Is there a tension between epistemology, your history and interest in epistemology, with the notion of projecting into the future, some sort of notion of future studies?
No, but look, the thing here is fallibility is crucial here, right? And the thing is we have to think creatively about fallibility, and what that generally means is providing institutional structures that enable corrigibility. That is to say, the correction of error once it's recognized. But we should actually be encouraging error. We should encourage people to take risks, much of which will turn out to be failures, but the failures will in some sense be, quote, rewarded, you might say. There'll be compensation, people will be taken care of, the society will benefit from it. So, you know, as it were, the failures will not be absorbed individually. Okay? But I do think that's the only way in which collective learning in a society occurs, and we have to, as it were, build our societies to enable that to happen. So I grant, yes, we do not know what the future is going to be, right? There is an open-ended issue. But we have to encourage people to be proactive about it. So there's a new book that I'm currently writing with co-author Veronica Lipinska. It's called Proactionary Imperative. It's the exact opposite of the precautionary principle. Okay? This is called the proactionary. I'll put this up on the board. If you're not familiar with the word... If you go on Google, precautionary has about 1.5 million hits, right? And proactionary, 35,000. And this is a term that's used by the transhumanist movement, which I haven't really said anything about, but they're the guys who like to go into cyberspace. But the point about the proactionary imperative is, in fact, that it encourages risk-taking, that this is, in fact, what it means to be a human being. So the kind of story that I was giving you to justify this renewed welfare state is a proactionary story. And so at the moment, we're writing this book to basically defend that as kind of an imperative on the basis of which to ground a welfare state. Because you see, I think one of the problems with the welfare state's public relations, you might say, is it tends to be very risk averse. So the welfare state is like the nanny state, as we say in the UK, right? It's about healthy eating and healthy, you know, don't do anything too crazy. Everybody should go toward the norm, right? And so it's very easily a target for people who want to defend individual freedoms, right? And so the Hayek people have a field day with the bad public relations of welfare state. We're trying to address this by saying, actually, we want to encourage people to take risks. We want them to be free in certain relevant respects, okay? But we also want society to benefit from it. You see, so that's kind of the background, you might say, knowledge politics of where I'm coming from here. I'm sorry, there's a whole stockpile of people. Go ahead.
We're doing fine.
Okay.
I certainly did not understand anything you said. In particular, I did not understand the role of knowledge about eugenics, how that...
I don't want to... Well, you want me to go to the whole... I mean, most of the people who supported eugenics were on the left.
That doesn't make it more understandable for me.
Okay, I'm not sure what you... Okay.
What is the role of this example? Which role does this example play in your art? Could you work that out a little bit?
Well, I'm not sure what... I mean, the point here being that we need
Why did you mention eugenics?
Well, because I do think if we're talking about what's happening now with regard to biotechnology and gene therapy and things like this, this is just, you know, kind of politically correct way of talking about eugenics. And I think if we don't actually make use of that history, not all of which was negative, that we're, in fact, really getting rid of a lot of stuff that can be very informative for us.
Yeah, now I've got it.
Okay.
That sounds good. It is a case in the book you referred to.
Yeah, I understand that, but now I think I have a hunch at least.
And
why?
The climate scientists are on the way, because the most recent iteration of climate science is to talk about human engineering.
Yeah.
Engineering humans.
Make people shorter.
Yeah, exactly. And giving us cat eyes, yeah. Right? Right, so we don't need so much light, because the eyes will do it for us.
Because for you now, in the 21st century welfare state, it's risk is individual choice. And I think for a typical social democrat in the 1950s, risk would have been individual choice. It would have been an existential condition where you're in, born into it as a member of the working class. And that, of course, is a completely, or yeah. Requires a total different mode of securitization.
No, I understand.
I'm wondering whether you see this type of risk also looking back at the golden age of the welfare state, or whether something changed?
No, look, I mean, I think what you're describing applies to the 1950s in terms of an ideological self-understanding of the welfare state, and I have no problem with that. I just think we need to reinvent the welfare state, which means that a lot of the welfare state's notions have to be justified in different ways. And I do think the individual choice thing, you know, especially if we're talking about, middle class population. Because look, I think the reality at the moment where we're starting from is what I've called in some works bioliberalism. Where in a sense people are sort of taking the risks if they can afford it and feel like they want to and so forth. And there's very little regulation or monitoring of what's going on. And so lots of different experiments and little things are happening. But there's no clear collective societal benefit from it. A relatively few percentage of the population actually benefits from it. And it's just kind of going into a sort of, you know, neoliberal free fall, where some people benefit, some people lose, and it's only those who can afford to do it who are doing it at all. And what I want to do is I want to formalize this as part of the way in which we govern societies, where we actually do encourage people to take risks, right? Take risks of the sort that perhaps are already being taken, perhaps illegally or only by a few people in the society, but then securitize against that. So I'm not too concerned about the individual choice rhetoric that goes along with.
Okay, but I just thought, is there an old notion of risk as an existential?
No, I think what you're describing is correct. No, I think that what you're describing is correct, that there is a sense in which protecting the poor, yeah, the safety net idea, yes, of course. Yes, I do think that was very much part of the old welfare state, for sure. But I think one thing you need to keep in mind, and I didn't talk about this, but it connects up with the eugenics point, is that when, let's say, in the United Kingdom, and this would be true also with Scandinavia as well, that with the institution of the welfare state, there were all sorts of research initiatives toward looking at what we would now call longitudinal studies, right, of how people live their lives and what effects they have, you know, for to get some clues as to what sort, you know, what sorts of consequences there are. You know, so in other words, even if you go back to the sort of traditional welfare state model, there was an idea that, in a sense, people are taking risks with their lives, and we should be able to collectively learn from that. I mean, it wasn't part of a sort of proactive strategy of encouraging people or selling the welfare state on that basis, but it was part of the research agenda that was funded on the back of it, certainly in the United Kingdom. And that's why we have all these longitudinal survey studies that take place. And if you go to Essex University, you can see all the databases of people's lifestyles, how they spend every moment of their lives, etc., what they do, etc. That was part of that original kind of conception in 1946. Okay? So I do think that there's a sense in which what I'm saying is not that far away from the original spirit of the welfare state, once you factor in just how interested in our biological makeup and the changes we undergo in our lives that the original welfare state theorists were interested in. Nico. Oh, sorry. Okay.
Yeah, thanks. Well, I'm a student of Zetland University, and I'm strongly interested in the issue that just raised. And my question is the following. So my understanding of what I find brilliant about the concept of a knowledge society, as given by Professor Schreier and others, is this idea of knowledge as a capacity to act, which
yes.
empowers so many people,
yes.
so many actors, mm-hmm. which haven't been empowered before.
Yeah.
Now, if we have a look at all these transhumanism, post-humanism movements, and if you go back to their fundaments, Max Moore and exotropy.
Yes, yes, exactly. He's the one who came up with the proactionary
right,
principle. Yeah.
Right. So this came basically out of a very, as you said, libertarian
exactly,
perspective,
exactly.
right?
Yes.
Now the question is, I mean, they had internal discussions. There had been a whole split up by a European fraction, right, which wants to have it analyzed and argued for it from a more left perspective.
Yes.
So how would you say, well, would there be like two different approaches, an American and a European? And second question as a follow-up, when I started to understand what the implications of this will be for welfare state, this idea of a negligible senescence and extreme long living, how would you relate that to like social security systems, which are far away from having any of that implemented in their logics?
Look, this is the thing for a course. No, you're asking exactly the right questions that should be on the agenda. I mean, I think it's fair to say that the converging technology stuff, the project that Nico and I were in, if you look at the European documents on this matter, it is quite clear that there is a concern. See, the thing about the long living business, the thing about living 1,000 years, as Aubrey de Grey says in the UK. Yeah, exactly. Well, the point about that, it's a double-edged sword, because you might say, my God, how are we going to pay for all these people who, you know, after 65 live another 100 or 200 years? No, the idea actually, and this is where the whole idea of enhancing ourselves come in, is that you can be productive longer so you can raise the Social Security age. Right? I mean, that's, you know, and so even within the European science policy documents, right, the idea is to, from some of this research, to raise the retirement age at least by 5 years, and if you were to do that and you had the productivity gain from that, right, because these people would still be working, that in fact you would be able to pay for a lot of the other issues going on in society. Okay, so I think that's part of how, at least from the science policy standpoint, this is being understood. It's being understood on these very economic, political economy terms, I think. Okay, so I think that is being thought about right now, okay? And I should say that this way of thinking about things has always been part of the history of eugenics. Okay? It's always been part of the history. This is not new. What's new is the technology and the kinds of interventions we can make. Okay? And this is the point about the intervention. You were making the point about knowledge is the capacity for action, the knowledge society thesis. Yes, exactly. This is why does one look at eugenics? Because one thinks that there's something in the genes, right? That the genes are the levers. The genes are the things you can operate on. They may be wrong about that, but the point is the knowledge is being developed in that kind of a way, so you can actually make strategic interventions. And with Keynes, you've got variables that you can actually operate on, so like money supply in the economy. Same sort of idea, okay? That's the key thing, right? That's the kind of knowledge for policy thing that is going on with the with Nico's version of the knowledge society thing. And I think, you know, what we might call what? Strategic basic research? If you want to use that kind of hybrid term, I think that's what that's about. Because converging technologies, right, is not about research that's going to produce results that are immediately beneficial, but it's going to set a whole long line of fundamental research questions that will yield benefits along the way and will get people thinking in a certain way. And so in that way, you can have your basic research agenda in a policy-oriented direction. And I think that's very much in the spirit of the welfare state. That was what the welfare state originally was about in terms of its knowledge policy, and what we need is a 21st century version of that. And I think Nico provides a lot of the elements for that kind of thing. And your final, the first point you came on, which was about the ideological splits within the transhumanist movement. No doubt about it. I mean, I do think there will be a fundamental ideological split between, you know, the precautionary and the proactionary people, okay? I mentioned the precautionary people, the people who think that, you know, any risk is too much risk, this kind of business, okay? Those people versus the proactionary people, I think, will be right-left, okay? But within those things, just like in the 19th century versions of the ideological movements, there will be splits. There's no doubt about it. And you're absolutely right, the American side tends to be much more libertarian, and the European side is much more socialistic, okay? And I'm on the European side of this issue. Yes, one more thing?
Short follow-up.
We have to...
Okay, let him have his short follow-up. Come on.
Just to have, like, because you mentioned him, de Grey used to decline any question on what the consequences would be. He's always, I read a few of his interviews, and also in his book, he's always saying that's a matter society has to deal with. Would you say that's the European perspective? Because the Max Mohr people tend to say, well, we don't care, right? It's very libertarian. But the great position saying that's... I mean, I'm the expert, but someone has to deal on that.
See, I think this business of... I mean, regardless of whether it can happen, I'm quite happy to grant that we will be able to switch some genes on and off and live longer than we currently do. So I'm willing to grant de Grey his basic point. But I don't see any reason to think that everyone will go for it. Okay? And this is the point about encouraging people to take risks. Because a lot of the risks that people will take, no doubt about it, will shorten their lives. There's no doubt about it, right? The kinds of risks that are on the horizon with regard to possibilities for drugs, gene therapy, and so forth, there's no guarantee people's lives are going to be increased by that, okay? And so I think there's a sense in which de Grey is kind of overhyping a little bit, even granting the point. I don't see any reason to think that everyone will want to do this, or in the process of getting to some state like that, there won't be a lot of lives lost in the process. People voluntarily taking risks that just do not pay off. But society should be able to reward or compensate that, even encourage that, because I think we all learn from those kinds of experiences. And if people want to do it, we should provide a basis, a social basis for them to do it. That would be my... So I don't have the kind of worry you're talking about.
We have two final questions, and then we need to wrap it up. Rainer and Nico.
Steve, you are a great synthesizer. But I'm not entirely convinced if you have the twist you put on our case studies are convincing, because, I mean, you said something in reply to Hans about eugenics, but I can't see how this relates to the welfare state problems we are discussing. So,
not the stuff in your case study, not the way you developed the case study. That's true.
Yeah,
I agree with you.
I think the three case studies, as I would put them, are about the question, how can knowledge be politically effective? And
what do the three case studies cover?
No. That's true. I mean, for those of you, well, the book hasn't come out yet, so none of you could have possibly read it. Oh, it's in German. Okay. Well, the point here is that the relevant aspects of eugenics that I'm concerned about from the 20th century are not actually really the ones that are highlighted in your book. And so that's true.
Okay, so I can see the point about Keynesianism. That's the obvious one that links to the first stage clear. But you know, if you look at climate change, there are discussions and proposals that say, you know, people have to sacrifice something, they have to have a lower lifestyle in order to save the climate and so on. So it's not immediately clear how this would coincide with an agenda towards...
But you guys are against that.
Sorry?
But you guys are against that.
We are against that, so I can't...
That's right. No. So the implicit other position is, in fact, more proactionary, it seems to me.
Okay. But I wanted to ask you, the terminology of the welfare state has become unfashionable.
Yes.
Even more so than, as we said earlier, knowledge society. So I think several people would say it no longer exists and it's a wrong idea anyway.
But it's not a wrong idea anyway.
Several people would say
yes.
And I wonder if it would not be better to address the issue beneath it, which is really about public goods. How to provide public goods. If you spell that out for climate change, for economic policies, for biotech and so on, what would it mean? Is there something to be defined and to be fought for politically?
Well, I mean, the thing that I'm very struck by, which came up a little bit this morning, is the degree to which we are volunteering giving up information about ourselves through the internet and other kind of digital means, okay? So things about ourselves, how we live our lives, what we buy, etc. That's already kind of out there, right? And people are voluntarily giving that. But it's not clear that there's any kind of public good benefit coming from it, you see? And in a sense, that is part of what the welfare state would do. It would kind of protect that kind of... It would continue to encourage the promotion of that information, so people should still, as it were, be leaving traces of themselves. But that knowledge should be made available in a way that actually benefits society as a whole, rather than the way it is at the moment, where it gets captured by various corporations or whomever are in a position to capture that kind of knowledge.
Well, I would say that benefits society indirectly.
Yeah, only indirectly. Yes, but we need to be monitoring what the long-term consequences of these things are, okay? Because there could be some quite significant changes, you know, that we want to sort of take action on as a society, and we need to have, as it were, some collective mind that is sort of keeping track of all of this.
But don't you need a philosopher king then for that? That sounds very sort of looking at society from...
Well, look, I have nothing, unlike some of those Canadian people, I mean, I have no problem with the macro statistics, okay? I have no problem with that. I'm very much on board with Keynes and an administrative state and all that kind of thing, okay? I think it's just a sort of, as it were, taking advantage of this kind of data that's being spontaneously produced. It's not like you have to force people to say this stuff. They're doing it already, but who's benefiting from it? You see, and this is where I think the state needs to come in to protect people's interests as they're exercising their freedom. Because they are spontaneously giving up this data in various ways of what they buy, what they eat, drink, whatever. But who's benefiting from it? And this is where I do think that the state has a role, and that will be part of the process of actually producing a collective knowledge base from which then other people who are not doing those things can understand what's going on. That would be my view, and it could feed into research and everything else.
So what type of laws should the state enact?
Well, it's tricky, I know, but we should try to deconstruct intellectual property regimes, that's for sure, right? I mean, I don't know if you're familiar, but the last novel that the novelist Michael Crichton published before he died was called Next. Next, right, about next species. And there's an appendix to that novel where he basically says that the government should ban any kind of intellectual property rights over anything having to do with the biological nature of human beings. And then the state, in a sense, the state should hold, as it were, the copyright or the patent for everyone to enable people to remain free. Okay? And I do think that's an interesting step in the right direction. But then the question is, what is the point of being free? And again, I want people to actually experiment. I actually want people to do all kinds of things. But the state has to protect that as well. Okay, I mean that's where I am on this. I think that you need both. You need to continue to encourage people to be as free as they are, you know, in terms of displaying their data and taking risky life choices. You want to encourage that, but you also want the public to benefit from it. You want both, and that's where the new welfare state would come in. That's the project, at least. And that okay.
What does the welfare state epistemologist Nikush Dad say about that?
Well, I really have a serious but maybe ironic sounding question. Let us be merry and take risks reminds me strongly of let us be merry and innovate, because in both cases, the promise of a convergence between altruism and egoism, and I think in both cases, a strong support for what we discussed this morning partly. That it doesn't make much sense to fence in knowledge.
Yes.
So what, do you see any similarity between pro-actionary and the notion of innovation, which is perhaps much closer to the liberal state than taking risks?
Well, see, the way I understand things at the moment is that there isn't, that the state is not itself dedicated to collecting the data of the consequences of all these different experiments and innovations that people take for public benefit, right? Certain corporations maybe, the state maybe sometimes, but there isn't a kind of dedicated state project, as it were, to figure out how can all of society benefit from the risks that are individually undertaken. I mean, and I think that would be part of what the welfare state would be about. It would be not just to encourage people to take the risks. Yes, people are already taking the risks, but the question is, does everybody benefit from that? You see, and this then provides part of the justification for people who don't take risks subsidizing the risk takers, right, through the tax system. And that I think is a very, and that's in a way that's a very traditional kind of welfare state mechanism that I would make sure is very centrally in place. And I think at the moment that's not so clear in the current regime that we're living in, that everyone would benefit from the knowledge of the people who happen to pursue it. Oh, sorry, but no, no, say it again. Say the question again. I'm not trying to be evasive.
I'm wondering about the conflation of taking risks and encouraging innovation. It seems to me there's...
Well, but entrepreneurship, come on. The nature of entrepreneurship is about risk-taking, right? Entrepreneurs are basically about trying to reconfigure the market. They're natural risk-takers. That's the classic definition of an entrepreneur, right? So that's how you get the two things together. And only difference now is that the people we're talking about are people who are entrepreneurs with their bodies, right? It's not that they have an idea or an invention, but these are people who are willing, as it were, to do something with their lives that potentially puts it in a risky situation.
All right.
Okay, sorry.